Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
This week on The Wheelhouse. The legislative session. What'll be considered? And what could pass? For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. It's the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. Oh, it's on now. This year's legislative session kicks off today here in Connecticut. Lawmakers plan to address the state housing crisis, the transition toward electric vehicles, and oh, so much more. And we're going to hear about that today. We'll explore what issues are top of mind in this year's session and what lawmakers hope to get done. And later this hour, we're going to talk about something else happening this week lawmakers might be invested in. The Super Bowl. You might not have bet a single set on the darn game, but you might be invested in it too. We'll tell you what that means a little later. But for now, we're on to the state capitol. When lawmakers met last year, they pushed through a new two-year budget. They advocated for public safety on our roads. And maybe most notably, they put off affordable housing. The new session kicks off around noon today, and it's a short one, scheduled to last from February to May rather than January to June. We want to know what lawmakers will be talking about this year, so we're talking to three of our favorite people. First, a hearty good morning to somebody sitting on my left in studio, taking her time before she goes to the state capitol to hear from the governor, maybe push off the governor's speech so she can go live from WFSB at noon today, Susan Raff.
Good morning, everybody. It is opening day for sure.
Opening day for sure, and we're going to hear what the governor says in about a few hours. Next up, the Connecticut Mirror's Capitol Bureau Chief, Mark Pazniokas, actually at the Capitol right now. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning to you.
Thank you so much for talking to us. And finally, it's the Equity King, also joining us, justice reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, Jaden Edison. Good morning, Jadison. Jaden.
Jadison,
does that happen too much? I'm sorry I did that. Jadison.
It works. It works. I appreciate the recognition.
Sorry, Jaden. I apologize. All right. So, Susan, you're going to get the first question here. Hey, how do you expect these first few days of the session to play out? What issues do you think are top of mind for lawmakers?
Well, it's hard to say what's going to be the first thing out of the gate, but there are some big priorities this year. You know, the governor didn't have much success with clean air and electric vehicles. He put forth a proposal last year. It was withdrawn. There was a lot of pushback. A lot of people are concerned about Connecticut following California being too restrictive, banning gas-powered cars, albeit by 2035. But I think that's a big priority, plus child care. I think the governor's wanted to do more with that last year. They did do some significant tax cuts, but he'll want to do that as well. And aging. I think they want to improve the care in our facilities, nursing home, assisted living, so that there are more people and so that people don't have that ratio where it's one person per, 20 patients.
We're going to drill in a little bit more on clean air and child care in a little bit. I'm glad you brought up those issues. Mark, any issues we're missing here? That was a lot that Susan covered. What can you give us now?
No, I mean, job one is the electric vehicle issue. The speaker really wanted to resolve that next week. I don't think they're ready. I don't think there's a final draft. But the game plan is to have the Transportation Committee hold a public hearing as soon as there are a draft that can be made public, and then have a vote of the full legislature. So
that
will be something
really early. That's quick.
Well, they want to get it done, and it may be an emergency certified bill, which means it can bypass the typical committee process. But they are committed, at the very least, to holding a public hearing after the draft is out and the public can review it.
Jaden, quickly, things that you're watching here, we'll drill into them a little bit more, but just give us a quick primer on some things that we ought to be watching here.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, first and foremost, on top of a lot of people's minds is kind of how the state legislatively actually will respond to a lot of the news with the state police. Right. I think there was a recent report, obviously, that found kind of, you know, gaps in the reporting as it pertains to racial profiling data. So I think you'll see a legislative response to that. I'm watching also how the rhetoric and conversations around bail reform advance. You know, this is something that picked up last year. Not sure there'll be significant movement on that in the short session, but definitely something to monitor as it pertains to conversations. And then lastly, I'd be watching a lot of kind of how the state responds to a lot of news in the off season of the legislature around staff assaults in prisons. But on the contrary, right, a lot of incarcerated people who feel as if there's not enough adequate programming and rehabilitation opportunities as, you know, as mandated kind of by, you know, an ambitious bill that, you know, was passed in 2022 having to do with solitary confinement and independent oversight, so on and so forth. So a lot to watch conversation wise, but it remains to be seen how much significant movement, you know, given the short session and kind of the quote unquote controversial nature of some of the issues that we're talking about.
I think Jaden is right. I think that while the independent investigation that the governor ordered with the Connecticut State Police did not find a lot of malicious intent when it came to record keeping, it did uncover quite a bit of failures in the way that things are put into the system, training, and I would not be surprised if they put something forward to try to rectify that.
I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit more about that and try to figure out exactly what they might push, and hopefully you guys have a little insight on that. But short session, as we mentioned, any of you can jump in on this, but what could be different this year than last year? Obviously short session, so maybe less things getting done, but not a budget year. What do we think?
It's not just a short session. It's also a session with another round of fiscal guardrails. You know, they renewed those last year. They passed bipartisanly in 2017. So last year they decided to renew that. And that's great. I think Connecticut's paid off over $7 billion of debt, but it does curtail what they can spend. So you have a short session and you have some strict guidelines on what they can and cannot spend. If they want to spend on something, they're going to have to take money from something else.
Mark, can I play you a clip?
Certainly.
All right, let's hear it.
The governor is not budging one inch on fiscal issues. I think he has made it clear to everybody who's here he's still sticking to the game plan that got him reelected by 13 percentage points.
It's almost like you're in two places in once. That's you earlier on Zoom, but also you in December, after reacting to something that the governor said about taxes and tax cuts. Has Governor Ned Lamont budged?
I have not seen or heard anything that would move me off of that little bit of analysis that I offered you in December. And if anything, he's doubled down. By the way, one of his favorite phrases, he loves to double down on things.
He'll be betting this weekend on the Super Bowl. Who knows?
he's going to be pushed mainly on, I think, trying to find some more funding for higher ed. You know, UConn has a significant shortfall. The state university system, which has the four regional state universities and the community colleges, you know, they're saying they're $140 million down. And they're talking, they've already ordered, I think it's a 5% tuition increase. So, you know, the speaker has told me that there's going to be a push to try to mitigate that. You know, the attitude always is, you know, OPM, the Office of Policy Management, can always somehow find another $100 million. You know, when you're talking at $21 billion annual budget or so, you know, it's that statement is not as startling as some of your listeners may think. But there's going to be a push to do that. As far as really changing the guidelines, I'm dubious as to whether that will be done this year for a variety of reasons. One, it is a short session, but it's also election year. And the legislature, even though they are at odds with the governor to a certain degree, even the Democratic majorities are hardly monolithic. There are significant numbers of Democratic senators and House members in particular who are very wary about changing the guardrails. So I think that may be a multi-year debate about, can you not blow up the guardrails, but can you adjust them going forward?
Right. And isn't that what Senate President Martin Looney talked about this week, about adjusting the fiscal guardrails? What do you think of that? Do you think that he'll actually be able to do that, or that will just be not a good plan and they won't do that?
Senator Looney has a long history of siding with progressives, of articulating his own personal opinion, what is the case. And then as the Senate president, like Speaker Ritter, will step back and sort of look at it more strategically. I don't see Senator Looney, going to war with this governor. This governor, is popular. He was reelected by a wide margin. And he was reelected talking about fiscal discipline. And so, again, I think there is that wariness. There is certainly a lot of frustration on the political left and in the communities of faith, social service communities, because there's no question there are unmet needs in Connecticut. They are well documented. For example, if you are a mother of a child in Hartford and you get your insurance through Husky or Medicaid, you have a really hard time finding a pediatrician that will take a Medicaid reimbursement rate. Most of those rates haven't been touched, since I think 2008. So again, the needs are real. You balance them against this history of Connecticut being fiscally mismanaged for decades and decades. And now we are on a path where, Connecticut all of a sudden seems to be this picture of responsibility. So that's going to be the tension. I think that's going to continue beyond this session and this election into next year.
I want to talk a lot on the balance of this segment that's left. There's about a few minutes left on this to talk about the state police scandal and anything that they could do. But just really quickly, you and Susan could do this for me, Mark. Help me understand how Republicans are now going to respond to the fact that, yes, there were big tax cuts last year, but of course they're saying there wasn't enough. So what will they say to that? And then what sectors are kind of suffering from the fact that the fiscal guardrails are not being adjusted or lifted? That's a lot. But help me understand
that's
this.
A whole lot.
I gave you guys a lot, but go ahead.
Well, I'll simplify it a bit. I think their major talking point, they're going to side with the governor on the question of preserving the guardrails. And they've already proposed a constitutional amendment, which is, quite frankly, not going to go anywhere. But that they've staked out their position. And they certainly are of assistance to the governor, as are the, there's a moderate caucus in the House Democratic majority. There's 98 of the 151 House members are Democrats. But on any given issue, there are 20, maybe 25 so-called moderates who are not averse to what the governor's approach is to fiscal issues, as well as the Republicans.
I think simplistically, you can't have your cake and eat it too, right? So you can't say, we want to do all of these priorities, and at the same time, we have to live within our means. So I think that, it's a hard lesson to learn, but I think what Mark pointed out is that it has helped Connecticut in many ways because of paying down debt. Our bond rating is better, our borrowing rate, the interest is lower. So I would be surprised if you hear from the GOP this year that we need to do more in the form of tax cuts. I think that they're going to have to figure out and prioritize what they want to spend money on, whether it's, child care, elderly. I don't know, with the infrastructure for the electric vehicles, is that going to be an issue? And I think education is really interesting to watch this year. We have a huge teacher shortage, and we've heard from paraeducators. They make $1 over minimum wage. We need more of them. So it'd be interesting to see what they're going to do with that.
Jaden, we touched on this in the beginning of the show, but you recently published a story on this about the independent investigation into Connecticut State Police after it was found that tickets filed by officers and constables, as it were falsified. Into that report, if you can, really quickly, the part about the Alvin Penn Act and the CTRP3, the Racial Profiling Prohibition Project, why it's important to carry this data. And then can you offer maybe any way that the legislature can weigh in now that this report has come out?
I think it's a few things, right? I think when you think about this police, the reporting and a lot of the conversation that over recent months was, you know, there was kind of this widespread, and in some cases, the question was the falsification that perhaps was identified, did any of it have to do with intent, right? Any of the inaccuracies or the questions that we have about the reporting, did any of it have to do with widespread intent to skew the data in any kind of way? And I think what you found in the investigation was that, okay, perhaps the, you know, the intent part was not as malicious or widespread as maybe, you know, suggested before. But what there was perhaps was, you know, the state police's neglect of the Alvin Penn Racial Profiling Act. And that included obviously failing to respond effectively to initial investigations dating back to 2018 that found that you have four troopers who have falsified ticketing data. I mean, failing to address information that pointed to broader problems with reporting and not having accurate infrastructure to making sure that there's consistent kind of reporting across the line. And the question, to answer the question of why that's important, well, the legislature and the general public oftentimes rely on this data around public policy conversations. And, you know, when we're talking about traffic equity legislation and how do we, you know, best, you know, ensure that there isn't racial profiling on the roads. Like, this is the data that folks go to when they're having these conversations. And what we found, you know, via the report is that there were significant failures by the state police to live up perhaps to that mandate. So, I mean, as far as what you could see, I think one thing that's clear is that the governor has kind of taken notice of this in some way, shape, or form. And I know the governor has told us that he plans to submit a bill to the legislature that would create legal consequences for officers who intentionally falsified data. You know, and also speaking with some of the judiciary co-chair, Senator Gary Winfield, Representative Steve Stafstrom, and recent conversations that I've had, and this was perhaps before the report came out, but this was something that was already at the top of mind, something that they plan on addressing in some way, shape, or form. And now that the report is out, I think you can see significant kind of conversations start to boil up in the coming, you know, weeks and
in
months.
Judicial, right?
About how to respond to this. Right, Judiciary Committee, exactly. But we do know for sure that the governor himself plans to submit a bill that would in some way address the situation. And I think that's the starting point. And we'll continue to see, I guess, what the appetite is to maybe do something that the governor, you know, isn't planning on addressing or you know, whatever the case may be. I do think it's a point of conversation that'll come up for sure.
And Jaden, you know, most, as you know, in the investigation found that a strong majority of these troopers who had been flagged, it was more a sloppiness or careless record keeping, not intentional. But there were six troopers and I think one constable who were referred for further investigation. And if you remember back, 2018, when those four troopers who were investigated and two quit. And so there wasn't anything done at that time when they found that they had intentionally. What do you think? Do you think that the governor will, with the new police commissioner, Ron L. Higgins, order, you know, to make sure that whatever wrongdoing, that there's an example set here?
Yeah, it seems like Commissioner Higgins was very adamant last week. I took note of this myself, right? Talking about specifically, he will not tolerate it. I mean, he said it with a lot of force as it pertains to, you know, any kind of things that would erode public trust in the system. I think one thing to also note, though, which I don't think was talked about as much, is that the independent investigation did not particularly look into intent around the underreporting part, which means basically that, you know, folks who, you know, maybe filed ticketing data in the court system, but didn't actually report to the racial profiling system as required by the Alvin Penn Act. And so that wouldn't necessarily be criminal, you know, level, but that is, again, you know, a violation of a state law that's been on the books for, you know, well over a decade. And so I do think that's something that folks, and I think Commissioner Higgins maybe acknowledged that is something that, you know, needs to be recognized, but also something that, you know, he seemed very strong and adamant about, you know, this is something that we will not tolerate, and something that moving forward, we're going to do the right thing. So I guess it remains to be seen exactly how they go about that, but it will be something to watch.
Something to watch as the session starts. And we'd be remiss if we didn't give credit to Jackie Rabe Thomas and her colleagues at CT Insider for breaking some of those stories about some of those tickets issues that were coming up with the state police going back as far as 2018, as Jaden mentioned. We have to go to break. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. Call us 888-720-9677 if you got any questions.
The
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We're a couple hours away from the governor's State of the State address and the opening of Connecticut's regular legislative session for 2024, and several people are going to be there today, including my guests, Jaden Edison and Mark Pasniokas of the Connecticut Mirror, and right next to me, to my left, one of my favorite people, Susan Raff, WFSB News, Channel 3. Hey, I want to remind folks that they could join the conversation, first of all. I mean, you've got all these great talents that know pretty much all there is to know about the law. Maybe I'm overselling it, but ask them some questions. 888-720-9677. Mark, there's been a lot of buzz around the electric vehicles. You called it job one. So help us understand how Connecticut can get closer to zero carbon emission models that mirror California standards and why there's so much urgency around electric vehicle legislation in 2024.
Well, there's a political urgency because of the California standards, which Connecticut has committed to back to 2004. And, you know, what was not anticipated is that those standards would evolve to one day call for the phase out of gas-powered vehicles, new gas-powered vehicles. You know, there's a lot of misinformation about what this would do. This would not, if it does take place, this would not force gas-powered cars off the road. There's going to be gas-powered cars with us for a long time. As your listeners probably know, there was a failure by the Regulation Review Committee to adopt the regulations. And there was a lot of concern about, would Connecticut be ready in 2035 for this brave new world? So what's happening is there are things being drafted that would reassure various constituencies, including the Black and Puerto Rican caucus of the Democratic majorities. Their members have indicated grave concern about whether, if you live in a multifamily house in a city, are you going to have a place to plug in? Are you going to be able to afford electric vehicles? So what we don't
That's
know
where we're getting into the electric grid. How on earth, I think I was going to ask can it support, but how on earth is our electric grid going to support this?
Well, there is the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority does have a plan. They've opened a docket. They're looking at it. So when people say there's absolutely no planning, that is incorrect.
Gotcha.
But it's all geared to things slowly developing over the next decade or so. And one of the things that the legislature is going to try to do is create a commission that would monitor the state's progress, and as well as the market's progress. And by market progress, I mean, are prices coming down on electric vehicles? Is battery technology getting better?
Kind of like a task force?
It's not a task force. They're talking about a permanent council that would monitor this stuff. And it would also be to reassure people that it would require a second look by the General Assembly in 3 years. So those are the things that are on the table right now to give people some confidence that Connecticut is not committing to something that is going to be unfeasible or even harmful for people in Connecticut.
I'm going to move on here and talk about a lot of cries for change in education, childcare, the healthcare field since the pandemic. One way, Susan, lawmakers are talking about addressing this is through simplifying the process to get a job in the childcare sector. So help me understand, you were talking about aging too, and taking care of people that live in convalescent homes, nursing homes, hospitals, maybe trying to get more staff there. So help me out here. What are we going to do here to help all these folks?
Well, I think the governor's push this year so far has been to encourage more people to go into healthcare. He was at the University of Hartford with students there. There's a scholarship program, but the governor's proposal would be to waive fees and application fees for people who are wanting to become nurses and teachers. So that's one way to get more people involved. But I think, you know, ultimately, pay is an issue for a lot of people who work in healthcare and also in education. Paraeducators make maybe $16 an hour. Many of them have two or three jobs, and we need more of them. So the proposals have to address that as well.
And one thing I kind of want to make clear here, because we were talking about this before the show, and this is a spicy bit of information we probably need on the show if there's an opportunity to source it or whatever. I don't know. I think you guys have this in one of your stories. But child care relies so much on federal dollars and kind of maybe getting like a Ray Dalio, Ray and Barbara Dalio or something like that to try to commit some money. So what are we talking about in terms of trying to find some money? Maybe there's somebody in OPM right now screaming, where's the pork? What are we going to do to try to fund child care soon?
And you might have more kids, I think, looking or parents looking this year because of the kindergarten age, right? So if your child has to be 5 years old and doesn't make the cutoff, then they're going to have to wait another year, and parents are now going to be forced to pay another year of child care.
The Speaker of the House is talking about putting money into a child care trust fund, and that would get out from under the spending cap. So there is that significance to it. And the idea, you know, his idea is that should not be something that would jolt Wall Street and make people think that Connecticut is falling off the wagon, the fiscal responsibility wagon. Because, you know, as everybody on this panel knows, childcare is one of those, a handful of issues in which there is all kinds of you know, cross-current support, right? This is, the business community is desperate for affordable childcare for their employees and future employees. There is a labor shortage in Connecticut, and we're at the point now where employers are looking at folks who are not currently in the labor force for a variety of reasons. And childcare tends to be one of those reasons. So, you know, there's people on the political left, you know, who are advocating for this. And CBIA, the state's largest business group, is as well. So I don't think there's
Senator Kevin Kelly says he's supportive of trying to take down fees here to try to get people to, and they're also going to simplify the process. Commissioner Beth Bye told me it was something like 13 steps to get licensed to be a child care teacher. And now they want to make it like three, something like that. Sorry, I interrupted you, Mark. Keep going.
No. But that's also part and parcel of what CBIA has been complaining about and what government has been struggling with for many years, which is the accretion of regulations. You know, what are still relevant? There's a look at even in state hiring, the credentials that are required. You know, does a job that's open, does it really require a four-year college degree, or is there some other background that would do the job? These are all things that are kind of in the mix about how you get more people into the labor force and how you fill, you know, these 100,000 plus jobs that are going wanting right now.
Let's dip back into the legal system. I just want to remind folks they can call us 888-720-9677. Jaden, our equity king, you've been following the fact that Connecticut's Juvenile Justice Policy and Oversight Committee is considering reopening and renovating the former CT Juvenile Training School in Connecticut, CJTS. Really quickly, why do they want to do that? And then, I guess, what's the hang-up in trying to get that open?
Yeah, so just a little background is last year there was a law passed during the 2023 legislative session that essentially required the judicial branch to review and update their plans for basically transitioning all of the children under the age of 18 who are currently in DOC custody housed at either Manson Youth or York Correctional to the custody of judicial branch. And so in order to do that, obviously the judicial branch had to figure out where are we going to house these children? You know, what's kind of the plan? And so in response, what you found was late last year, the judicial branch presented a $67 million plan that essentially would reopen the site of what was known as the Connecticut Juvenile Training School to accommodate those children. And the thinking was that, you know, we did all these studies, you know, we talked to a bunch of people and we couldn't find the space to house, you know, the vast majority of the children who are going to be transitioning into our care. And so this is perhaps the only solution that they saw fit. And so the JJPOC, as you mentioned, talked about this more recently. And it's something that brings a lot of emotion for a lot of people, right? Understanding that, you know, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School, as it was before, obviously, you know, has spent, well over a decade since its inception, honestly, right, with, you know, complaints and reports of, you know, neglect and alleged abuse and, you know, all these things pertaining to the well-being of the children who were housed there. And so any kind of conversation to kind of even think about reopening, you know, that, you know, the space in that facility, even if it's completely reimagined from what it was previously, you know, obviously has brought, you know, a lot of emotion and is definitely something to watch, you know, this legislative session. I think what you could potentially see, I think any kind of reopening renovation is going to take many years, right, to say the least. But I do think one thing to watch out for are the conversations around any kind of funding that will be allocated for.
What are we talking about in terms of costs?
Right. And so particularly so the overall plan, right, is a kind of $67 million plan that includes a lot of things. But I think the starting point is, OK, we need to figure out, you know, how much the studies or excuse me, we need to figure out, you know, what that plan would actually entail, which first starts with obviously studies of the renovation. And so that could cost the state up to roughly $1 million, according to that proposal. And that also could last anywhere from 18 to 24 months. But it's a multi-layer plan that could stretch well over a decade. If kind of implemented as is now. So a lot of conversation to watch around that. But I do think the part that's relevant this session is conversations in the Appropriations Committee about, is this something that we're going to move forward with in terms of the judicial branch's plan and the studies of the renovation that could ultimately lead to the renovation, the reimagining of this site. You know, obviously that was, you know, condemned for so many years and in a lot of ways, you know, create a lot of trauma for a lot of people who were at that facility, you know, during its years of being open.
We're going to stick with some justice issues here. I just want to go to Jack in Middletown, who has a question, I think, for Jaden about the investigation on the state police trooper investigation there. Jack, you got us? I'm not hearing Jack. But Jack, I believe what Jack was trying to say was that one part of the investigation that seemed like it didn't get any pub, or at least one record that didn't get looked at maybe was the license plate numbers as they passed by as if they'd issued a ticket. You hear anything about that involving troopers at intersections entering in license plate numbers as they passed by and as if they'd issued a ticket, anything like that, Jaden?
Yeah, not to my knowledge. Gotcha. Or something that comes to the top of mind now. I think overall, you know, what the independent investigation obviously looked at was answering the question of how did what was outlined in the audit, what actually happened, right? The audit points to, you know, look, basically we're identifying all these discrepancies and that inaccuracies, you know, with the data. We don't know exactly what the issue is, but here's what we think could have happened. And so what the independent investigation did was try to answer some of those questions. And so particularly it was around, you know, the intent of any kind of discrepancies in the data. Was there malicious intent to skew the profiling data? And then obviously on the flip side of that is how has this system worked or not worked? And what are the gaps that need to be fixed by lawmakers and by the state police themselves?
Going to do a quick broad brush here on some justice-related issues here. The ACLU of Connecticut got their priorities out there. They want to reform the way people apply for housing in Connecticut so that formerly incarcerated state residents get a better shake at finding a place to live. Gus Marks Hamilton has a quote for us here.
Housing is a basic human right. Yet 79% of incarcerated people have been denied their right to housing due to a criminal conviction. And here in Connecticut, people living with a criminal record face over 550 legal barriers to being able to meet their basic needs.
Jaden, reentry for formerly incarcerated persons is a big issue here in Connecticut. Can you talk to me about other barriers to successful reissue you've been reporting on?
Yeah, I think
reentry.
This has been a conversation for such a long time, and I think the more recent thing to think about is, you know, in recent years, Connecticut has closed a number of its prisons. And what the argument by a lot of the community advocates has been is, let's reinvest the roughly, you know, what, more than $20 million in funds that we're saving annually by the closure of these prisons and reinvest them back into people who are transitioning, you know, back into the community, which obviously we know a great number of people who are incarcerated will return home, you know, at some point. And so I think what you find is that a lot of people who are at halfway houses and, you know, people who are transitioning out, to your point, you know, we're having larger conversations about affordable housing in Connecticut. And this perhaps is what some people feel like is maybe missing from the conversation, is how do we, you know, bring people who are incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, to the table, you know, because obviously the thinking is that the people closest to the problems are the people closest to the solutions, you know. And I think, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, more recently, you know, we were doing some reporting out at a halfway house in New Haven, talking to a gentleman who just talked about the kind of difficulties that come along with, you know, trying to transition back out, right, with, you know, what they feel was sometimes a lack of discharge planning and a lack of assistance, to where, you know, some people who are supposed to be at a halfway house, for example, transition, you know, the gap between incarceration and, you know, being free out in the community is, you know, we're staying well past our stay, or, you know, we're struggling to get the guidance and for people to point us to resources. And so I think it's something that's something definitely to monitor. Especially around the budget, right? It is, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, with the quote unquote fiscal guardrails and things of that nature, that this is perhaps a big priority for the administration. But it is something that, you know, again, for years and years has been a point of topic and conversation.
About 90 seconds left in the segment. Mark, give me your final thoughts on things we need to pay attention to in 2024, the legislative session.
It's money. It's to watch the push and pull between the legislature and the governor over how they can find more money for higher ed and some of these needs we talked about. I mean, this really comes down to, that's the essence of the short session, as well as the other things we chatted about. I don't think there's any real mystery as to what's going to be unfolding in the weeks to come.
Anything on the ballot referendum that they need to do before that comes out, or anything on early voting?
No, there's still some scuffling over whether or not there's sufficient funding for the municipalities to implement early voting, because it's the money really wasn't there. I mean, this is a burden on the cities and towns. So there'll be some push and pull on that. That's not huge dollars, but you know, you may see some money added for that.
Susan, you got the last word here.
All right, I'll throw out something we haven't talked about, but I think it's important. And now that Connecticut has passed legalized marijuana, we're seeing THC in seltzers being sold at Ooh. Convenience stores and liquor stores. And the potency or the milligrams are so low that you don't have to be 21 to buy it. That's a huge concern, certainly for parents. People are buying it. Companies, I think, are trying to skirt around what's happening. So I think you're going to see something with that, because that affects a lot of people and drinking and driving. And even if the potency is so low, if you get drug tested at work, you still have THC in your system. So yeah, I think they're going to take that off.
Maybe you talk about that at 12 when you're live on the air. Maybe you try one on the air. I don't know.
Not for me, but
thank God I'm not your general manager in Channel 3.
Yeah, I don't think they'd like that.
Susan Raff, you'll hear from her at 12 o'clock live, I think, on WFSB News Channel 3. Of course, Mark Pazniokas is going to cover the heck out of this session, so pay attention to him at ctmirror.org, as well as Jaden Edison, justice reporter, and really doing everything he can to pay attention to some of these issues impacting communities in Connecticut. Thank you all for joining us. Up next, my old colleague's going to join us on the show, the CT Insider's Jackie Rabe Thomas. And I've got a burning question for her. Is anybody going to do something about the state's housing crisis? 888-720-9677. 888-720-9677.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/TAP support. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
If you've never donated to this station before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days. And thanks.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We've been talking all hour about what Connecticut lawmakers might pass in the upcoming regular session. We're saving housing for last. The 2023 regular legislative session ended in controversy. Advocates for affordable housing were dismayed by local lawmakers for failing to enact major change. To see if lawmakers will do something about it in 2024, I've invited one of the best housing reporters there is, Connecticut Insider's Jacqueline Rabe Thomas. Jackie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Frankie.
Hey, I just wanted to just point to a couple of calls that we had before we got here and see if you can help me unpack this. We had somebody talking about, this was, I believe, Krista from Bridgeport, talking about making something like $60,000 a year and struggling to afford housing. And then we also heard from somebody, David in Mansfield, voicing opposition to the so-called desegregate CT work, live, ride initiative. Failed last year. Curious what the panel thinks about this initiative, but housing in rural and suburban areas. You want to help David out there before we start and I ask you a few questions?
Sure. So building around, mass transit, that's a huge government investment that the state's put a lot of money into, and the federal government has put into our train systems and the infrastructure that surrounds it. And so there's been a push to really build up those downtown spaces, those transit spaces, and have more of housing density in those places. Whether that's, reserved for low-income individuals or just more density that by design you kind of get prices to potentially be cheaper for rent in those communities with higher density. That has not made it across the finish line in the few years that it's been brought up year after year. It was a huge contentious issue last year. A lot of people have really dug in on both sides of the issue. And so it really depends whether or not the legislature decides that this is the year that they want to ask their members to vote on such a controversial bill. I'll just put out there sort of the politics is that every member of the General Assembly is up for re-election this coming November. And so asking your members to vote on that somewhat close to an election, it might be a little hard for leadership.
Yeah, we had Krista who was commenting earlier. I want to clarify what she said. She said she can't afford to move within Bridgeport on a $60,000 salary. I'm watching my neighbors get priced out while hotels get converted to apartment buildings for Gen Z yuppies. A lot of frustration there, Jackie.
Yeah, there is affordable housing that's being built, but it's just not enough. This idea that there will be enough housing that the state could fund to build to help out people like this woman in Bridgeport is just, it's questionable whether that will really fill the void. And I think she's sort of showing that it's really not going to be enough, or it has not been enough yet, at least.
Just really and quickly, so, how far are we on? How far short are we on units?
So there was a housing needs assessment that the state's Connecticut Housing Finance Authority completed just to see how many people are spending more than 30% of their income. And of those who make less than the state's average income in Connecticut, there's 169,000 people throughout the state that are spending more than 30% of their income. So that means, we're roughly 170,000 units shy of having housing available for people, so they're not cost burdened, so they can still afford daycare, so they can still afford a car or their bus pass, all those other things that still you need to pay for to live.
You recently reported on a story done by New York, or study done by a New York City-based economic consulting firm, Urbanomics, which showed that Connecticut's racial and economic segregation is among the worst in the entire country. How does Connecticut's housing structure play into that issue?
So not great. We have, particularly the regions of the Bridgeport area, so, you know, Fairfield County area and the communities that surround Bridgeport, as well as Hartford and the areas that surrounds Hartford, are among the most segregated places in the country. And so when you look at the impact that that has, you know, it's not just about people who, where people live. It's about sort of this idea that resources come with people having sort of a mixture of income and communities. And so this idea that communities in different towns are, you know, border each other, Fairfield and Bridgeport, for example, they border each other, but vastly different income bases of what they can afford for their schools, for their roads, for, you know, whole range of services that are needed to provide to your community.
How much of this is tied to our zoning laws?
So a lot of, not a lot, what can get built is based on town zoning rules. And the state of Connecticut has that authority to determine zoning rules, but there's a state law that leaves that up to 8-2, leaves that up to municipalities to determine zoning rules in their communities. And so you have places like New Canaan, where 99% of the land is zoned for single family homes, and you need special permission to open even a duplex or a threeplex, you know. So like this idea that you need special permission to go through to get any type of density in a lot of communities really does prevent the opening of new housing that would potentially be naturally affordable.
So there's that clash. You have the state having authority to determine zoning laws, but then the municipalities have some kind of zoning policy initiatives because of the laws. So how can the legislature get to rectify that this session? Maybe. I know that's hard to do in a short session, but, and is the political will there, I guess?
Look, it hasn't been done. There's a reason why the Zoning Enabling Act has been in place for decades in the state of Connecticut. Every year at the legislative capitol, at the state capitol, you see the law that allows some state involvement or some state enforcement when towns don't allow housing to be built is regularly sort of proposed to amend it, to scale it back. And the reality is that the General Assembly has been, this is a bipartisan issue, right? The General Assembly has been governed by Democrats for over two decades in both chambers, and the governor's office for for 13 years. And so, you know, this is really, if Democrats want to get this done, they could. It's, again, it's an election year. I'm not sure they're going to have the will to ask their members to vote on such a controversial issue.
And that's basically overturning the Zoning Enabling Act, or at least changing some of the amending it.
Right. You know, having different requirements, you know, sort of this idea of a stick versus a carrot. The state has really taken and leaned into the politically easier carrot of offering money to provide housing. And so that's not a new approach. Money has been there for decades for communities to step up and allow funding to be built. You know, if you look at these applications for those grants, it's regularly your Bridgeports, Hartfords, New Havens that are applying for that funding. So this idea that all of a sudden you have much more funding for these grants, which is true. There's the legislature last session did approve about $800 million for more funding to build affordable housing and offer home ownership opportunities. But the idea that towns will now take the state up on that offer for that funding, I think advocates will tell you that's a sort of a fallacy.
Jackie, thank you so much for joining us this morning and for taking questions from the listeners. That was very helpful. I appreciate it. Eagerly waiting to see how legislators tackle this issue. I'm eagerly awaiting to meet your new son, Hudson, one of these days. How about that? I'll talk to you soon, Jackie. Thank you for coming on.
Absolutely.
As we close this week, we wanted to talk to you about the volatile business that is sports betting. First and foremost, if you're a bettor, you could lose and lose a lot more than just money. If any of the following triggers a sports betting addiction, please call the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling at 1-888-789-7777. Even if you aren't a gambler, you could stand to win big Sunday at Super Bowl 58. American Gaming Association projects $23 billion bet on Sunday's matchup between the Kansas City Chiefs and San Francisco 49ers. And as Connecticut Public's been reporting on this issue, just who wins the game matters to local taxpayers. That's why we're talking about this. Connecticut residents kind of have something on the line here. Since the state could turn a profit on legalized sports betting, win for the betting favorite, the Chiefs, could result in a net revenue loss for the state. That's because the state's three sports betting operators would have to pay out a lot of bets, and the state would have less revenue to tax. So, quick recap, Kansas City Chiefs win could be bad for sports betting business. A win for the San Francisco 49ers could be good. Either way, we hope you enjoy the game. Thank you so much for listening to The Wheelhouse this week, produced by Chloe Wynn, technical producer Kat Pastor. Thank you so much to Katie Pellico for helping us out in studio. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse.